Carlos.
Okay. I got the easy part of the job. I think poor Stacy got the short straw. So it's nothing easier than to speak for Cold Lake Mare, because it is really a great success of physics of the last 30 years or so. So here are some of the reasons why CDNs become the standard model. It is an ab initio, fully specified model of cosmic evolution and the formation of cosmic structure. Something very strong going for it is that it's based on the known laws of physics. You don't need to invent any new laws of physics. And these laws of physics were in fact formulated and tested completely independently of lambda CDN. Now, it has very strong predictive power, and indeed, it has been used to make a number of predictions, and the bold here is deliberate, that been subsequently verified empirically, for example, micro background, large scale structure, galaxy formation. So let me run through CDN quite quickly. Here's a cartoon that illustrates how we can test this model. The story begins, of course, with inflation and quantum fluctuations in the inflaton field seed the universe with small density perturbations, which are in the model the precursors of the galaxies that we see today. These small perturbations are amplified by cold dark matter, which makes its appearance at some early time. And then the first of, during the Big Bang phase, these fluctuations grow, and the first opportunity that we have to test the model comes at recombination through the emission of the microwave background radiation, which allows us to test some of these ideas. But that's not the only test we can do. After recombination, structure continues to grow, amplified by gravitational instability, by the dark matter, and we get many opportunities then in the remaining 13.4 billion years to test how the model works. So it's the linear phase of growth fluctuations, and that is a nonlinear phase. Now, what really revolutionized the subject, unlike Dan Hooper, I was around when these ideas were proposed. It was a real revolution, and was a postdoc in Berkeley and here, and this plot was the basis for the revolution. Before, the power spectrum of density fluctuations motivated by physics, a power spectrum like this was proposed, cosmology just really didn't exist. You didn't know where to begin. But this power spectrum, which is calculated in the early 1980s by Jim Bardeen and Gene Peebles, changed the picture completely, because for the first time we had a well-defined model that in principle predicted the entire formation of structure in the universe. So once you have a model, and then you know the initial conditions, and it just becomes a computational problem, especially if you're interested in the nonlinear parts of structure formation. Of course, linear theory you can solve analytically, but the nonlinear phenomenon you need to solve through numerical simulations, which was a subject that was invented at that time. Not here, in fact, in the USSR by Klipin and Chandarin. So the idea then is that if you know the initial conditions and you know the interaction laws, well, then it's just a classic problem in computational physics. You have to solve the relevant equations. If you're interested only in the dark matter, for example, you just need to solve the collisionless Boltzmann equation, the Poisson equation, and the Friedmann equation. If you're interested in the visible parts of the universe, then the problem is much more complicated, because you need to contend with radiative hydrodynamics and all the subgrid, as we call it, physics, not resolved in simulations, of star formation and so on. But the problem is very well defined. You solve these equations in a computer, and you sit around and wait and see what happens. Now, this plot illustrates the real predictive power of this kind of methodology. Here is a universe in which the dark matter is not cold dark matter, it's hot dark matter, a neutrino with a mass of about 30 electron volts. That, in fact, mass had reportedly been measured behind the Iron Curtain by Lyubimov and colleagues. In fact, as it turned out, that experiment was incorrect. But you can see how powerful this methodology is, because we were immediately able, by comparing the predicted distribution of galaxies with the universe that was known then, the biggest survey at the time had 2,187 galaxies. I know, because I had to plot each of them by hand. And you could see here that you could immediately rule out the idea that the neutrino had a mass of 30 electron volts. So it was one of the early successes and of this approach, and it shows how it is powerful indeed. And these were the first simulations of what later became known as Lambda CDM. And if you buy me a beer, I can tell you why, when we all thought the universe was much more elegant and simpler than we know today, and omega matter was one, and there was no cosmological constant. If you buy me a beer, I can tell you why we decided in 85 to run what later became the standard model of cosmology. Now, so here's a modern version of that picture, where on the right-hand side are the simulated universe. Here there are slices from the Millennium simulation of with the same geometry and selection function as observed surveys, and you can just see by eye that this model is very successful in predicting the large-scale structure of the universe. But perhaps what really established CDM as a standard model was the successful prediction of temperature and isotropies in the microwave background, as you can see here represented beautifully by the Planck satellite. So if Lambda CDM is the correct description of a universe, what you're looking at here is nothing less than quantum fluctuations from inflation. But the key point I want to emphasize is that these observations, these measurements, came after 20 years, well, 15 years after the predictions were made. The predictions were made again by the great Jean Peebles and also by Bondman and Stathew in the early 1980s. Here's the prediction for the power spectrum, the 2D power spectrum that you're all familiar with. This preceded the observations. COBE flew in 1992, preceded the observations by many years, by a decade or more compared with Planck. And here is this tremendous tribute, I think, not just to cosmology and CDM, but to the whole of physics, that we're able to make predictions like this, which match the observations with exquisite accuracy. And a simple CDM model has six parameters, physical parameters, that get you can determine from that match to the data. In particular, we know what the density of baryons is to a precision of better than a percent. We know that the density of cold dark matter is to a precision also of better than 1%. And if you compare these two numbers, what we have here is a 40 sigma detection of non-baryonic dark matter using only data at redshift 1000. So now here's a summary of 30 years of work in the subject. Here's now the matter power spectrum at redshift zero. Here are the microwave background measurements extrapolated to redshift zero using linear theory. Here are the measurements of galaxy clustering, and there's a region where the two overlap. And this is why this is the standard model of cosmology. But it's not only these statistics or these fundamental properties of a universe that the model predicts correctly. There's also quite a lot that we have learned from CDM regarding galaxy formation. Let me just highlight one topic. Here is, of course, a huge community that works on galaxy formation. Some of them, some of you are here. Here is the mass function of dark matter halos from the Millennium simulation. And we know this perfectly. There's no ambiguity. The arrow bars here are smaller than the thickness of the line. So there's a number of halos of different mass in a typical patch of the universe. Here is the measured galaxy luminosity function, number of galaxies, function of the luminosity. These are faint galaxies, these are bright galaxies. And let me compare them for you here, where you can see that here's the mass function of halos, are arbitrarily normalized. And the mass function of halos has a very different shape from the observed galaxy luminosity function. All the complexity and richness of galaxy formation is encapsulated in the difference between these two shapes. And after 20 or maybe more, 30 years of working on galaxy formation, we understand that it is complicated, and the reason why this shape morphs, if you like, into that shape as halos of different mass are occupied by galaxies has to do with complex feedback processes. Here at the faint end of the luminosity function, I'm going to tell you more about it in a minute, supernova feedback and the early reionization of hydrogen suppress galaxy formation in small halos, and that's why the luminosity function has this shape. And here at the bright end, it is feedback produced by supermassive black holes as they accrete and become AGN. So we understand that quite well. And now we can now do those, these are calculations done a long time ago using analytical techniques. We can now do those. It's been a breakthrough in the subject using full hydro, ab initio hydro simulations. It's been a breakthrough in the last few years. Several groups, some of you here, have, after many years of trying, managed to succeed in making a realistic looking population of galaxies following the same methodology that's been so successful for dark matter, following not just the dark matter, but also all the baryonic physics that are responsible for what we can see in the universe with our eyes. I'm going to just tell you about results from the EAGLE project by the Virgo Consortium, because that's the project in which I'm involved. Here are some galaxies that have been taken, these images, from the Hubble for the Hubble Atlas. Morphologically, they don't come from the Hubble Atlas, Neil. They came out of a computer. And here is the stellar mass function that I just showed you before. Before it was luminosity, and stellar mass. And you can see that the simulations, these ab initio simulations, do a really good job, not a perfect job, but a really good job of accounting for the number of galaxies that we see in the universe with different stellar mass. Now, so so those are the successes. Now I want to address this so-called small-scale crisis of CDM. The conclusion of this, if you want to go to sleep, is simple. CDM crisis on small scale, what crisis? There's no crisis, and let me just go through. Actually, it turns out that Dan Hooper touched upon these topics yesterday, but I'm actually now going to present you the evidence. So the first is the infamous missing satellites problem. The second one is the too big to fail problem. And the third one is the cost problem. So Dan talked about these yesterday, waved his hands a lot. I'm just going to show you here some calculations. Now, the so-called missing satellite problem comes from the observation that when you do an embody simulation of a cold dark matter halo, like the Milky Way halo, then it ends up having hundreds of thousands or millions of small substructures that you think in principle might harbor a satellite. And when you look at James Bullock's plot of the satellites in the Milky Way, you find there's only about 50. And so you say, well, what? Clearly, there's something wrong with this model. There's nothing wrong with the model. You're just doing the wrong comparison. This is stuff we can see, and this is dark matter. And that has been understood for a long time. In fact, I just told you about it, that the vast majority of these small halos never succeed in making a galaxy for two pretty basic fundamental principles of galaxy formation theory. The first one is the observation that after recombination, the universe is reionized by gas is neutral. And then when the first stars form, then they reionize the gas. And you know that if you reionize hydrogen, then you also heat it up to 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So the gas now at 10 to the 4 Kelvin has high entropy, and it simply cannot cool in halos whose effective temperature is less than 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So those poor halos will never be able to accrete a baryon. And the slightly bigger halos, where gas does cool, they all it needs is for a few stars to go off, supernovae to go off, and they expel the rest of the gas, and you end up with a halo with just a handful of stars. So these processes are well understood, and they were calculated in first in sketchy way by Bullock in his, as a postdoc, and then in greater detail by Andrew Benson. And here is the luminosity function of satellites, numbered as function of luminosity, bright ones here, faint ones there. In those days, in 2002, only 11 satellites were known, shown here in red. These are the models. There's a lot of scatter in the models. But Andrew's models made an important prediction, that there should be a population of ultra-faint satellites, shown here by the black line, which were not known at the time and were subsequently discovered in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So it's another example of a prediction made before observations. It doesn't tell you, of course, the model is correct, but it tells you that if CDM is the right answer, then we know why there are so few satellites in the Milky Way. Now, just to correct one of the factual inaccuracies from Dan's talk yesterday, this is Ben's paper, but I don't really want to pick on Dan. He's a friend of mine. I could pick on Dan, but I won't. I want to make a more substantive point. Here is Ben's paper called Dark Matter Substructure Within Galactic Halos, George, You're an author, you should remember your title. Now, the point I want to make is the divide that exists and the disconnect between the community of astrophysicists and the community of particle physicists. And that's nicely encapsulated in the fact that this paper has over 2,000 citations, and the two basic papers that solve the problem, James's has 637, ours 282. And that just shows you how there's very little communication between these two communities. Particle physicists keep writing, inventing particles to solve the missing satellite problems. Let me just tell you one thing. If you want a grant proposal to invent a particle to solve the missing satellite problem, make sure you say, don't send it to Carlos Frank to referee, because you know what the outcome's gonna be. No. Oh, come on. Now, we can now do this with hydro simulations. Here's what the local, this part of the Eagle project, called the Apostle project, a project of simulating the local environment, led by my former postdoc, Till Zavala. Here's what the local group would look like if we were able to see the dark matter. Sadly, we can't, so the local group looks a lot more boring. Here is the Milky Way, well, simulated Milky Way, Andromeda, and you can see what I just told you. Here's the big ones, these two, these one, that one, they make a satellite. All the other ones, all the little ones, they make nothing for the physics that I just told you, now calculated in a completely different way in these ab initio hydro simulations. Now, so this is an important plot that is worth bearing in mind. This shows you, you look at the right axis here, it's fraction between 0 and 1 of halos. It's a function of mass. This is a fraction of halos that are dark, okay? And it's a very steep function. All halos with mass less than about 5 × 10⁸ are completely dark, not a single star forming them. Halos bright, more massive than about 10 to the 10 solar masses, they all make a galaxy, and the transition is very sharp. Come to that later again. But not surprisingly, when you do the calculation, the comparison that Andrew made and James Bullock, then you get the same answer, of course. It's physics. So here's the luminosity function, or mass function, actually, of satellites. Here are the dark halos, many, many dark halos, and very few satellites, and it agrees perfectly with the observations for the Milky Way M31. And the local volume. So I think the point here is that when Byron effects are taken into account, the observed abundance of satellites is exactly what you expect in CDN. There's no such thing as a satellite problem. Now, what about too big to fail? That's a lot more interesting problem, and say that not just because Mike is here. That's a much more interesting problem, and I'll just tell you very briefly, the solution is actually a lot more elegant. And so what Mike Boyle and Colching, using my simulations for the, to begin, pointed out was the following. So the mass of a subhalo is not well defined because it's inside another halo, but a measure of its size comes from this quantity called Vmax, which is the maximum of the potential energy, the square root of the potential energy, of the circular velocity curve, square root of Gm over R. This is a label to measure how deep the potential wells are. So Mike observed that M-body simulations, I should have put that in red, produce many halos, produce about 10 massive halos with a large value of Vmax. This is large by the standards of small galaxies, but the Milky Way has only 3 satellites. So he said, well, too big to fail. We could understand why the little ones don't make a galaxy, but these are too big to fail. What actually happened? And the answer is actually quite neat. And it's, again, baryon effects. And what happens is this, that if you have a halo at early times that's going to produce a visible satellite, it has supernovae that go off, and they produce a wind that ejects quite a lot of the gas at early times. So this halo at early times loses a fraction of its mass, and of course it cannot grow as fast as it would have otherwise grown if this had not happened. It's a subtle effect, and here is what happens. If you compare Vmax in a hydro simulation with this wind against Vmax divided by Vmax in a dark matter only simulation, you find that for halos less than about 50 kilometers per second, there's a suppression in the value of Vmax by this phenomenon that I just told you about. It's only a 15% effect, but that is large enough to explain away Mike's problem. Here is a number in the dark matter only simulation. Here's Mike's observation, that the number of halos with Vmax bigger than 30 is about 10. When you do the same calculation in a hydro simulation, then you find, indeed, because of this small reduction, that there's only about 3 of those. Oh, come on, Josh. Give me a few more minutes. All right. So when binary effects are taken into account, there's no too big to fail problem in CDN. Now, so the third problem, core cusp. Now, I could give you 10 talks on core cusp. I'm obsessed with it, some people say, but let me just get to the gist of the problem. So as we all know, one of the surprising, perhaps, results of CDM theory is the fact that dark matter halos all have density profiles, density function of radius, described by a simple curve, the NFW profile that describes the halos of all objects from dwarf to galaxy clusters. If instead of plotting them in physical units, you plot them in dimensionless units, then you scale them by the size of the object, then all these dwarfs, clusters, and so on fall on the same line, which is this cuspy profile where the density diverges like 1 over r towards the center. So that's the cusps. That's what NFW theory predicts for dark matter halos. Again, dark matter halos. Eagle and some other simulations I'm not talking about called Origa, they all have NFW cusps. Now, but the interesting question is, does nature have cusps or cores? It's a huge debate going on in here. I don't have time to tell you more about it, especially with Josh here breathing down my neck. Let me just put it like this. Here's an expert, Kyle Ullman, talk to him. I have not seen a single convincing case of a core. Every time people claim there are cores, you can always find a flaw in the argument. So I'm unconvinced. However, let us assume cores do exist. Say they were found. Does that mean CDM has a crisis? Well, the answer is no, and we've known that again for many years. So here is an experiment we did. I did it just to get Ben Moore off my back, where he kept saying that of course CDM is wrong. No, and the reason is this. Here is a density profile, and what we did is we took a sphere, and we did a very simple experiment where we allowed a galaxy to form adiabatically inside this halo. As the gas, which can dissipate, cools and collapses, then it increases its gravity, self-gravity increases until it becomes self-gravitating. At that point, it's self-gravitating, has all the binding energy, it brings in dark matter, the cusp gets cuspier. At that point, release it in an explosion, and what's going to happen? Well, the binding energy moves away from the center, and a core forms. So that is where you can make a core, if you are so inclined. That was later seen, many years later, by a number of people, Justin, who's here, Fabio Governato, and others, and it's all essentially the same physics. Now, should simulations make cores or not? Well, I don't know either, because these phenomena are not resolved in simulations. There is a key parameter here, which is the following. When you're doing a simulation, you don't resolve the stars, so you need to decide at what density threshold the gas gets turned into stars. And whether or not you make a core depends on the arbitrary choice of this parameter. So in Eagle, we chose this parameter to make sure we get the right stellar mass function. But if you change it, you can have any kind of core, depending on what you choose for that number. You have anything from a cusp to cores of different sizes. It's not a big deal, and there's no core cusp problem. Now, Josh, here you and I have a problem. I was going to say something about MDAR, since Stacy's sitting there. Then I'm going to have to skip my slides on MDAR, unfortunately. And just to say that we were surprised at this very nice data by Stacy here. We were surprised when he published this data that relate the acceleration, total acceleration you see in this galaxy, to the acceleration due to baryons. I don't have time, George, but let me, because I want to say one more thing. Let me just say that surprisingly, and possibly surprisingly for Stacy, the Eagle simulations seem to follow that relation. I can explain why during the discussion, but let me just go to my last point, which is something that came up yesterday. Can CDM be ruled out? And the answer is yes. And finally, after 30 years, which I spent trying to rule this theory out, I know how to do it. The answer we already discussed yesterday, I just want to show you the evidence, and it has to do with gravitational lensing. So the fundamental prediction of CDM is the mass function of halos continues to rise and rise and rise until you get to LA, whereas, for example, if the dark matter was a 7 keV stellar neutrino, one dark matter, then the mass function would cut off because the power spectrum is cut off For a 7 keV stellar neutrino, it cuts off at a mass, well, it begins to fall below CDM at a mass of 10 to the 9, and it cuts off at about 10 to the 8. And so here you have two possibilities which make completely different predictions. CDM tells you the universe should be teeming with these small halos. You don't see them, they're dark. If the universe is made of warm dark matter, then you shouldn't find any of these small halos. And it turns out that this can be detected through gravitational lensing. Simona is going to tell you a lot more about this. The point is that if you have, you have an Einstein ring, which is produced when a source, a lens, and an observer are perfectly well aligned, then you get one of the most beautiful phenomena that nature has produced. I have a better slide of this, but hold on. This one, sorry. You get these Einstein rings or these strong lenses. However, of course, not just the main lens, but lenses, any subhalo nearby, anywhere in the line of sight, would also lens. I'm nearly done, Josh, I promise. And so that produces a distortion in the Einstein ring. Simona found one. Here you see it, actually, this is a very large distortion produced by a halo that's not interesting from this point of view, because you can even see it by eye. It's too massive. But by careful modeling, you cannot see these distortions of the 10 to the 7 solar mass halos that we're interested in here, but you can extract those from the data. So just to finish off, if CDM is right, we should find many, many of these 10 to the 7 solar mass halos. If warm dark matter is right, we should find zero. And what do you need to do that experiment? It's a paper here by Ran Lee and colleagues. And all you need, if the detection limit is indeed that, all you need is 100 lenses, and they're already sitting there. And with 100 lenses, and admittedly a perfect experiment, if you have this detection limit, if the universe is made of warm dark matter, you'll be able to detect the cutoff here with huge accuracy and completely rule out CDM. Conversely, if the universe is made of CDM, you'll rule out any warm dark matter model with an interesting mass conclusively. So here, then, the conclusion is that if the dark matter is a 7 keV stellar neutrino, you can rule out CDM, and if the dark matter is CDM, you can rule out the stellar neutrinos. Let me just put on my conclusions here. CDM is a fully specified model that makes predictions, many of which have been verified after the fact, and there's no small crisis of CDM. If there is, if you compare visible things with dark things, you have to compare the same thing, and now we have the ability to compute these Baryon effects, and all these supposed crises can be resolved once you do the appropriate calculation, and these distortions of strong gravitational lenses offer a clean test of this model and could even potentially rule it out. I'm done, Josh.
All right, let's thank Carlos. Questions? Yelena.
So I have several questions, but on this last point about whether you can rule out CDM, so you told us, like, with the core cusp, that baryons can affect the matter distribution and look like a core, and that's fine. But is there absolutely no sensitivity to how baryons are affecting the matter distribution in this system that you're talking about? So you mm-hmm. do have to model the lensing halo mm-hmm. profile, and when even if you marginalize over that, aren't you effectively marginalizing over baryonic physics when you marginalize over that profile?
Well, this is a wonderful question. So let me, this is exactly the key question. Now, I have a slide here which was commented out, like most of my slides are. Let me just show you one slide to address this point, because I do mean it when I say this is a really clean test. Now, here's again from another paper with Ran Lee, and Simona will confirm this. What happens is this. For lenses at redshift 0.2, for example, like the slack sample, but it's true even more so for lenses at higher redshift, you can ask who is responsible for the signal. Subhalos, which could be affected by many nasty things, like, for instance, they interact with the galaxy here, they get tightly stripped, and so on. Is it them, or is it the field halos that dominate? And the answer is the field halos that dominate by about a factor of 10. Now, these field halos are completely dark. They've never seen a baryon in their life. They've never been inside a galaxy. If we have learned to calculate something precisely over 30 years, is how many of those halos there are as a function of mass per unit volume. So we know that to perfection. So the reason this test is so clean is because the signal doesn't come from subhalos. It actually comes from these projected line of sight halos. Now you do need to model the lens, you need to model the source, and that's why it's complicated. Now, Simona will tell you all the uncertainties. As she said, I'm an optimist. I think these lensing, people who do the lensing know how to do these kind of things. So, but indeed, you need to model the lens and you need to model the source, the so-called macro model. But you know, it can be done, and Simone has demonstrated. She's found already some of these structures. She found a very bright one, she also has a dark one. So it is possible, but it's not simple. But the test is totally clean, right? It's just a computational statistical problem, how to extract that signal.
Anybody else? Sabir, and then we'll come back to Neelima.
Can you say something about how sequence does in velocity space? Everything you have shown, very impressive, has to do with sizes, density contours, etc., in position space. So for example, peculiar velocities in our neighborhood out to about Shapley and beyond, 300 megaparsecs.
Yeah.
I suppose you know that in the 6-degree field measurements recently of the peculiar velocities are consistently above what might be expected from the simple analytic expectation from CDM.
But they're below. The Hubble flow around is very quiet.
I wonder if your simulations have improved these expectations.
Well, I mean, it depends what exactly you're talking about, Sudhir. So, for example, the Hubble flow around the local group is abnormally low, not high. Right? So Jerry Ostreicher wrote a paper many years ago talking about the Mach number of the Hubble flow. The velocity dispersion, well, in addition to the Hubble flow being very quiet, but it's very cold, right? So the question is a very good question, and the answer is that, of course, the velocity dispersion of galaxies around us depends on the environment quite strongly, and in particular, it depends on, as it happens, the mass of the local group, not surprisingly. Now, so you can actually invert the question, and in the LAMCD model, you can ask what mass should the local group have in order to account for the coldness of the Hubble flow. And the answer is, be forthcoming in a paper by Julio's former student, my current postdoc, Azi Fatahi, who shows that the mass is completely reasonable mass for the local group, lower than you might at first guess, is enough to explain that particular observation.
Yelena?
So for the 1999 paper you put up with Ben Moore,
yeah.
One argument Ben made that I found very compelling was that he was saying if there was all this dark substructure, then we wouldn't get these very thin disks that we see.
Yes.
Because his argument was the substructure would pass through the disk, disrupt it, thicken it, mm-hmm. etc. Isn't that a good argument against the existence of these dark subhalos?
Well, so first of all, it was Toth and Ostreicher who first calculated this in detail in a paper in 1986 that Julio knows very well because we then wrote a paper together showing that, in fact, even in those days when omega matter was one, it was rare to have thin disks, but you could have them with the universe with lambda. Then, because the disks formed relatively late, then the bombardment is actually very small. And so the detailed calculations of disk thicknesses, for example, with the Eagle simulations, we don't see any problem. I mean, the problems we have to do with the resolution of the simulation, but making thin disks is not a problem. And that's partly because of the way in which accretion happens in a universe dominated by lambda, which is a lot less than in a universe with omega matter equals one, and just because most of the objects get tightly disrupted before they get anywhere near the disk. And the few ones that do hit the disk, I mean, we have one hitting our disk now, the Sagittarius, they do some damage, but not in a way that would negate the theory.
Hitting goes to seven squared, so it's dominated by the ones you see.
Yes. Correct, yes.
Okay, so in the interest of having time for discussion, a broader discussion after Stacey's talk, let's move on. Thank Carlos again.